Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Dan, because Amy's off today. It's just going to be me. Of course, over the weekend, we had this horrific mass shooting at the 4th of July parade in Highland Park. Six dead, 31 injured. Started at a little after 10 a.m. yesterday, shooting this individual who was taken into custody by police on Route 41 in Skokie Valley Road in that vicinity yesterday evening. Was apparently in an elevated position with a rifle and just opened fire on the crowd. That's what we know to this point. Six dead, 31 injured. And unfortunately, Governor Pritzker, who made his way to Highland Park to offer comments and express support, thank law enforcement, all appropriate, use the occasion, as is the wont of leftist politicians, to push for his gun confiscation agenda. Here's the governor.
It is devastating that a celebration of America was ripped apart by our uniquely American plague. A day dedicated to freedom has put into stark relief the one freedom we as a nation refuse to uphold. The freedom of our fellow citizens to live without the daily fear of gun violence. If you're angry today, I'm here to tell you, be angry. I'm furious. I'm furious that yet more innocent lives were taken by gun violence. I'm furious that their loved ones are forever broken by what took place today. I'm furious that children and their families have been traumatized. There are going to be people who say that today is not the day, that now is not the time to talk about guns. I'm telling you, there is no better day and no better time than right here and right now. It's the 4th of July, a day for reflection on our freedoms. Our founders carried muskets, not assault weapons. And I don't think a single one of them would have said that you have a constitutional right to an assault weapon with a high-capacity magazine, or that that is more important than the right of the people who attended this parade today to live.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. That's Governor Pritzker again talking gun confiscation as the suspect in the case was not in custody at the time, as families were still being notified about the loss or the injury to loved ones. Governor Pritzker used the occasion to propagandize about guns. I'm sort of at a loss of what to say about these things anymore. We've talked about so many mass shootings on this show. Unfortunately, we've had to. Here's another one. We tell you what we know about the shooter. We tell you the context. We go through all of the contributing factors depending on the particular traits of the individual, motivations, if they're even identifiable. We have the same question here. No obvious motive. And try to glean something from the online chatter of people who knew the shooter. You have hack politicians like Spalding go out and say, let's ban guns. You talk about throwing more money at mental health. And it just all seems to come up a bit short, if we're being honest with ourselves. So at least let's go through the characteristics or what we know about this individual who is in custody now. And by the way, the good news, I know some people, again, the online chatter, suggesting that they should have released the canine officer on that guy when they had him on the ground on Route 41. Or he should have never made it to prison, complaining about police effectively using de-escalation to get him out of his car and on the ground and safely into custody. I think the opposite, I mean, just on principle. But in addition to that, I'm not saying we're going to learn more than we know from the fact that this apparent shooter survived and will be tried. But we might. And so you at least have the person apparently responsible for this in custody, and you have the chance to get a more complete picture. Maybe there will be something that provides more insight into why someone would do something so horrible. I don't know. I was thinking about the Aurora, Colorado shooter, the movie theater shooter. We don't mention names on this show, but you know who I'm talking about. And, of course, he was taken into custody, and he stood trial, and he was crazy, but not crazy in the sense that he didn't know right from wrong, and he was convicted in a court of law, not institutionalized. Convicted, I think, of, if I'm remembering correctly, 24 counts of murder. And what we found, it's unsatisfying. Of course, we didn't find out as much as we want, and lawyers representing him trying to prevent evidence from coming into trial that would perhaps provide more texture to what was going on, including a notebook that he had with his psychologist, if you remember that. But you did get some information because he survived and he stood trial. You had the knowledge that was provided in open court, the evidence provided in open court, that he had been thinking about, borderline consumed with killing for a decade before he opened fire in that theater in Aurora, Colorado. And so I'm looking at the online chatter from people that are allegedly this guy's friends or worked with him because he was this half-ass rapper. Awake the Rapper was his handle. And so, yeah, people say I made music with him a few years ago, so on and so forth. And trying to dispel some of the things that people are wont to do in these circumstances, score political points. There's some picture with him with like MAGA paraphernalia. So he's a, white nationalist, MAGA, blah, blah, blah. And you have people people who, again, this is online chatter, not identified, not verified, but it feels like there may be some insight there, saying that he was not political, that he was basically an isolated stoner who was left to his own delusions, that not left, not right, not a gun nut. This is what people who are presenting as knowing him and making music with him over the last several years. He's a 22-year-old guy, so these are people talking about making music with him in his teenage years, I guess, late teenage years. That not political. The one person said, never uttered an anti-Semitic word. He was fascinated by like symbolism he thought was interesting, but he didn't necessarily mean that he adopted it as part of some coda philosophy on life. And as I said, stoner lost to his own delusions in isolation. That's what's coming across from those who are suggesting they had some interaction with him. Chris on the Dan Ryan, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, Dan. Good morning. And I can't even say how tragic this is, but the problem is it always seems to be the gun's fault, not the person wielding the gun, unfortunately. I grew up with guns all my life, and, my dad used to say that you could put a gun on a table in the middle of a field for 100 years, and it'll never kill anybody until someone picks it up. So is it the gun? guns' fault, or is it just because we have, as a society, allowed these people to be not medicated, but just we should have been watching this guy. We should have done something different. But again, that's hindsight. So, you know, is it part of society's fault? Probably. I don't know. But your opinion, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I mean, thanks for the call. It's, you know, if I had the answer, I'd share it. I assume if anybody had the answer, they'd share it. We've tried a bunch of different things, and these sorts of terrible massacres continue. So, and of course, the problem is, I think, is that if you try to just make it about one thing, then you can't explain why all those other people who have that one thing or do that one thing don't do this thing. So it's just so much more complicated, and that's why it's so individually specific, and people don't want to hear that. People want to hear somebody say, if we just do this, it'll end. And I don't think people can credibly say that, which is why you mainly hear politicians say that, because most of them aren't credible. Regarding the gun, you know, this guy has no criminal history in Lake County, at least. No criminal record in Lake County. I don't know. It hasn't been reported of any institutionalizations. I don't know if there was any mental health treatment that was undergoing or previous. I know that they found the rifle at the scene. This is the reporting, and they traced the gun. I guess they traced the gun to the person now in custody through the serial number. But there's no indication that it was obtained illegally. We don't know. I haven't seen reporting on how he obtained the gun, whether it was legal or illegal. So this is still fog of war stuff.
This is the Morning Show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today. 773-467-5630. 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy's off today, so it's just me. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Of course, we're talking about the carnage over the weekend in Chicago. Six dead and 31 injured in that parade shooting in Highland Park. And the last report I saw, 55 shot and 7 dead in Chicago. Hell of a 4th of July weekend in Chicagoland, huh? And that also includes over the weekend police officers being injured. A police officer in Little Village who was ambushed. You have to take the totality of this culture that we have, particularly in Chicago, but of course not limited to Chicago. Take a listen to what happened. Let's start with the police officer responding to a domestic. Did you hear me? I said responding to a domestic for those defund the police who want social workers to show up to deal with a habitual felon who's apparently beating his girlfriend because she made the 911 call. Huh. Here's how that went.
10-4, 12-24.
12-24.
a domestic battery here at 1342 West Taylor. It's apartment 607 on the 6th floor. She is Tamika Williams. That's her daughter. Tamika Williams just texted her and said the live-in boyfriend beat her up. The offender has been known to carry a gun. Officer down. Officer down. Any available units on zone 3.
31, I'm close right over there.
All right, units on the citywide. We're getting a 10-1, 1342 West Taylor. We got an officer down there asking for an ambulance. 1342 West Taylor.
He's still up here.
All right, any units on the citywide. Any units headed to 1342 West Taylor. We got an active shooter situation. 1342 West Taylor.
431,
I've had to
over with the right.
10-4, can you all give us a...
Right.
All right, 10-4. All right, unit, stay clear of the air. 1220, can you give us a safe route in?
Yeah, through the first squad, through the front of the building.
The front of the building, okay. And do we know where the offender is right now?
He's still up there in the upstairs in this floor. Can you secure this perimeter squad? Get all officers and secure the building here.
Okay, we need all officers to secure the building. The safe route in is through the front. The offender is still on the scene.
And ultimately, police captured the offender, and he's been charged with attempted murder of a police officer. And despite the officer being shot multiple times, the last report I saw is that he's expected to survive, thankfully. The individual taken into custody, arrested January 6th of 2018, armed habitual criminal, I'm looking at his rap sheet from Cook County, arrested in January of 2017, unlawful use of a weapon, felon on parole, possession of use of firearm prior. I'm looking at April of 2016, street gang contact, parole, essentially meaning he's a parolee, and so on and so forth. So this is the individual types of individuals that Chicago police are dealing with on a daily basis, and there's a lot of them. There's a lot of them. Oh, and by the way, the city is making more of them by not intervening when you have the opportunity. For example, CWB Chicago reporting over the weekend. Remember how we reported a few days ago that two 15-year-old boys charged with robbing a woman of her car at Clark and Fullerton on Monday were the prime suspects in a string of auto thefts and muggings of women in the area? Those 15-year-olds were released after being charged. Last night, this would have been Friday night, a woman was mugged by two people smack dab in the middle of the robbery pattern's hot zone. Chicago cops arrested one of the robbers. He's a 15-year-old boy. Boy, it's a fascinating coincidences, don't you think? About an hour before the woman was robbed, an armed carjacker took a man's brand new car just a block away. That offender remains on the loose. Huh. So you're telling me these 15-year-old boys that were charged with robbing a woman and of her car on Clark and Fullerton on Monday, prime suspects in a string of auto thefts in the area, they're released, and then on Friday they're back at it. Streeterville. I could just go ward by ward in the city. 39-year-old man shot during an apparent robbery in Streeterville early Monday. That would be yesterday. Earlier in an unrelated incident, a woman was shot in Old Town. No arrests have been made. Shootings on the north side this year over year. As of July 4th, near north side shootings, these are our friends at CWB Chicago, again, compiling these stats. 21 in 2019, 14 in 2020, first half of the year. How many shootings near north side? The Ritzy neighborhoods, Streeterville, Gold Coast, Old Town. 21, 19, 14 in 2020, ticked back up to 18 in 2021. This year so far, 38. So 6 and 31, dead and injured in Highland Park. 7 and 55, dead and injured in Chicago proper. Cops being ambushed in Little Italy. If you saw any of the videos over the weekend with the all the honor students that were roaming around celebrating their independence, you saw cops being injured by these Clockwork Orange kids running around opening the doors of police cars and throwing fireworks at, you know, lit fireworks at the police officers. Here's an example of what I'm talking about. Dispatch again.
All right. A lot of vehicles out there. It says throwing fireworks at the cars. Everyone go over there, please. Units that are at the 10-1 per 1630, please keep your doors locked. People are opening the doors and throwing fireworks in squad cars, supposedly all across the city. Keep your doors locked.
Yes, Roger, just so you know, I'm not sure if anyone told you. I'm behind ambulance 7. My partner's in ambulance 7 with the injured member 2512. We're going to Resurrection on Telecast.
Are you with ambulance 7 going to Resurrection with 2512?
And 4 squad.
In Portage Park, Chicago police officer injured during a disturbance there Sunday morning. Police officer traveling in a marked patrol car when an object struck his windshield, causing it to shatter. The officer stopped the vehicle. Then several offenders approached the SUV. One offender began kicking the headlight of the vehicle. He was transported, and he got back up, and he was transported to local hospital for minor injuries. But you got people, you know, throwing whatever they're throwing at a police car that's substantial enough to shatter the windshield and then follow up by attacking the officer's car, at least, if not the officer, if they could get to him, it would seem. Three shot, one fatally after gunman opens fire on crowd in backyard of Grand Crossing residence. Go on and on. There was this piece in the Chicago Tribune last month. This guy, Ernest Willingham, who testified in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee about his experiences with gun violence, they call it. That's the same thing you heard Jelly Belly call it up in Highland Park. Gun violence. To disconnected from human conduct. The guns are accountable. Individuals are not. Willingham, who's only 19 years old, testified Senate Judiciary Committee. He wanted to walk senators through what it's like to make life decisions when the fear of gun violence or getting shot weighs heavily on your mind. His before he was born, his father was shot in both knees when he was a young child living in Cabrini Green. Bullet struck his brother next. A gunshot to the groin when he was robbed, another to the leg at a party a year later. Willingham's cousin was also shot at the same party. His mother recalled finding a bullet hole in her blinds and a bullet in the living room of her 10th floor Cabrini Green apartment. There were nights she had her family sleep on the floor for fear of stray bullets. She taught the kids how to hold the wall, walking with their backs to a building to minimize the odds of getting shot when gunfire was rampant. Talked about attending more funerals than weddings, his family. So it's persisted for some time in Chicago, and it's been exacerbated by the abdication of anything resembling adult political leadership in the city, in the mayor's office, in the Cook County State's Attorney's Office, in the Cook County Sheriff's Office, the Cook County court system, and that would obviously include the state level as well. And so this is what you have. This body count. John in Naperville, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, two quick points, Dan. Thanks for taking my call. Number one, anybody who thinks that the police are, you know, being too aggressive or they should have tased somebody or shot them in the leg, they should watch that video of that officer getting ambushed. Horrible, horrible. It's a very dangerous job. Number two, if the politicians aren't going to do the will of the people need to do their own will. Can't we have, like, a constitutional amendment or a referendum that if you have a gun, you go to jail for 5 years. If you're a criminal with a gun, you go to jail for 20 years, period. Why can't we do that as citizens?
Well, we can't. Sure. Thanks for the call, John. I mean, there are minimum mandatories. We have minimum mandatories for crimes committed with a gun, and there's been talk of doing, I mean, this has always been part of the conversation. I mean, that, look, we have three strikes and you're out for essentially for violent felons. But there was pushback from who? The gun confiscators, the left. They want, you listen to their rap. They want to confiscate guns because that's going to make people safe. And they turn out, no cash bail, people who commit crimes with guns. So as long as what we take the violent habitual criminal's gun away, then we can turn him back out on the street because he doesn't have his gun anymore. So I guess he's no longer a threat to public safety. You know, the poisonous politics of this prevents enhancing public safety. And you heard it over the weekend, most notably from the governor in Highland Park. Something else, too, since we're mentioning cops, this was interesting. In terms of the impact that this has on police, this lawlessness, the lack of a backup from your civilian political authorities, the demonization, the feeling I have to go out there to be a pinata rather than to enforce the law and keep law-abiding people safe, which is sort of the feeling you get talking to Chicago police, isn't it? Suicide rates per 100,000 in the United States. General population, 14 in 100,000. Police, 22. Chicago police, 34. Actually, 35. Chicago police, 2.5 times more likely to commit suicide than the average American. I think that says something about the job. And by the way, about 50% more likely than police officers generally in the United States. I think that says something about the job in Chicago. Bob in Buffalo Grove.
Good morning, Dan. Thanks for taking my call. It's always a pleasure talking to you. Let me offer the following. I assume you saw the arrest video. And the
In Highland Park?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I noticed that the perpetrator did not resist arrest. Mm-hmm. I wonder what the outcome might have been if he would have decided to take a run for it. You might want to opine or whatever. It took place in Akron this past, I don't know, it was Friday. It's amazing to me that the people that, you know, resist arrest, their outcome versus those that... Obey police.
Thanks for the call, Bob. Appreciate it. Yeah, we will get to Akron, too. I appreciate you bringing it up. Glenn in Streamwood.
Hey, Dan. I just got two words. Dantrell Davis. It's been 30 years this October. He was a 7-year-old walking to school with his mother. And that, and I don't think anybody remembers him, but that's at least how long all this has been going on.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks for the call. I remember the story. Cabrini Green. And I mean, are used sort of as proxies for, the death culture that is Chicago. Ben Wilson, Hadiya Pendleton. We could go on. It's sad. And it's getting worse. By the way, I was mentioning this, too. It's like, well, you know, back in the 80s, there was 900 murders. And last year we had 800. Yeah, well, back in the 80s, we also had 3.5 million people in the city. Today we got 2.8. And it's not just, of course, murders, and it's not just shootings. It's the general lawlessness we're describing that anybody who's lived in the city for an extended period of time can appreciate. And it's not limited to certain neighborhoods. Not that that was ever, you know, tolerable or something to accept, but it's everywhere and people know it. It's different. Frank, St. Charles.
Yeah, good morning, Dan. Yeah, to the previous caller that called for stiffer sentences and mandatory minimums, the reason you can't have that is because this would disproportionately affect people of color, and you really can't have that. You know that.
Well, I mean, that's the argument that's made. It's exactly right. I mean, this is why the gun confiscators say exactly what Frank just said. And so you, we want law enforcement, but it's got to be, you know, reflective of the demographics of, I mean, rather than reflective of who's behaving badly and who isn't. And if you want to talk about root causes and all that, we can talk about that. You want to talk about the quality of the schools and who gets what opportunities, we can talk about all that. But if you don't want to put people away who are demonstrated that they are violent threats to public order, then I don't think we have much else to talk about.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630. And learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, because Amy's off today, she'll be back tomorrow. So it's just me, and of course, last hour we spent our time talking about the dismal business of these horrors that occurred over the weekend in Chicagoland, the parade shooting in Highland Park, 6 dead, 31 injured, the lawlessness, general lawlessness in Chicago, which had 55 shot and 7 dead. And by the way, that's, you know, 31 and 6. I'm not saying one is more important than the other because every life is equally important, but 31 and 6 is every weekend in Chicago. And we're hearing from politicians like our governor. The 4th of July celebration, our Independence Day celebration, celebrating our freedoms marred by tragedy. Well, it's definitely marred by tragedy. But were people like Pritzker, Brad Schneider, the congressman from up there, were they really celebrating our independence? Do they really celebrate this nation, its founding, the principles upon which it was founded? Doesn't seem like it. Does not seem like it. On the one hand, celebrating our founders and the principles and these seminal documents that provide the foundation of a free society. On the other hand, I spent all my time undermining everything in those documents. And I'm going to do so here on the bodies of 6 dead people and 31 injured in Highland Park, which is exactly what Pritzker did. I think that's the sort of thing that perhaps sparked this interview that went viral, this video statement that was made by U.S. Marine Carl Sperlin Deckel, who just turned 100 last week. And this was... I guess the statement came the same day as we lost our last surviving Medal of Honor recipient, Woody Williams. That was Wednesday. I'm not exactly sure that I think it was in terms of this video. I don't think this was intended to be widely viewed. I think this was a video made by the family, you know, because they wanted to celebrate Marine Deckel's 100th birthday, but it's just the nature of it hit a nerve, had some resonance, certainly did with me because I retweeted it. Here's what, by the way, Carl Sperlin Deckel, this Marine, World War II veteran, Silver Cross recipient as well. Here's what he said.
I don't know. I've lived a good life. I mean, I've had a lot of happiness, smiling, telling everybody that everything was beautiful every day. If I went into my church and didn't say everything was beautiful, they'd think I was sick. And I'm not that way. I mean, I sincerely believe in this old world that everything is beautiful. I mean, if I wake up in the morning and see these plants out here and all those flowers that are in there and the green grass on the ground, that's beautiful. And people don't realize what they have. They bitch about it. And then nowadays, I am so upset that the things we did and the things we fought for and the boys that died for it, it's all gone down the drain. Our country's gone to hell in a handbasket. We haven't got the country we had when I was raised. Not at all. Nobody will have the fun I had. Nobody will have the opportunity I had. It's just not the same. That's not what our boys, that's not what they died for. It's just not it. I'm so sorry. I'll be all right. Just takes me time to get over it. Why me sitting here like this? See, all this going on. It's crazy. It's just, Emily, it's just not the same. That isn't what we fought for. Oh, well. I should be worried about it, I guess. I'm 100 years old, they say.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Your reaction to what U.S. Marine and Silver Cross recipient, World War II veteran Carl Sperlin Deckel had to say. Not the country we fought for, not the country boys died for, World War II and since. He might be onto something. I think it's more than might. Rod Dreher had an interesting piece on where we are as a country over the weekend in American Conservative. The 38% of U.S. adults who say they're extremely proud to be an American is the lowest in Gallup's trend, which began in 2001. Extreme national pride in the United States has been trending downward since 2015. Falling below the majority level in 2018, it's nearly 20 points lower than it was a decade ago. Even Republicans, whose national pride eclipses that of Democrats, 58% of Republicans say they're extremely proud to be an American. That's its lowest point in the trend as well, the last 20 years. Independents, their extreme pride at 34%, likewise the lowest on record for a group. Here's Rod Dreher's commentary on it. We become a country ruled in many public and most major private institutions by people who hate its founding values, who hate its traditional liberties and moral norms, who hate the race of the majority of people in the country, and who wish to stir up racial hatred among us, who hate orthodox forms of religion of a majority of its people, and who are busy destroying the pillars of national life and cleansing the memories of the next generation so they will forget what America ever was. One party promotes this, and the other party is too cowardly or otherwise disengaged to defend their own country's traditions. The business class is all in on celebrating decadence. The military-industrial complex and the foreign policy elites want to spread it throughout the West. The light unto the nations has turned itself into the neon filaments of the trans strippers' neon. Is he onto something? Well, to Rod's point, U.S. Army and PBS pick BLM singer who belittled the land of the free, Mickey Guyton, to highlight the Jan 4th concert, the annual Independence Day concert at Capitol 4th. Yeah, Mickey Guyton, who in the wake of the George Floyd death, supported BLM, BLM advocate, Marxist organization, remember. Not about race, fundamentally about Marxism, and who has condemned the land of the free. Uh-huh. Yeah. Bob Woodson, our friend, I find it particularly distressing the Department of the Army would be one of the supporters, because what Black Lives Matter has said is that America is fundamentally flawed. It's racist at its core. It's almost a criminal organization. Well, why would you expect young men and young women to volunteer to sacrifice their lives for a country that its own military says is racist and therefore culpable in perpetuating injustice? It's a contradiction, you think? Well, Bob Woodson, of course, from the civil rights era, leader in the civil rights era, to present, commenting on the U.S. Army selection of BLM singer. Oh, you think Roger is not onto something? Still not convinced? City of Orlando apologizes for message critical of Independence Day. The city's newsletter. A lot of people probably don't want to celebrate our nation right now. We can't blame them. When there's so much division, hate, unrest, why on earth would you want to have a party celebrating any of it? Yes, America's in strife right now, but you know what? We bought the fireworks, so. Of course, they apologized to whoever might have been offended by their statement. They certainly didn't mean to denigrate America. Really? Mm. So what's it going to take? What's it going to take to be the country again that U.S. Marine Carl Sperlin Deckel fought for and so many died for? Rod Dreher, going back to Dreher, you know, this conversation we sort of have, we give lip service to. Yeah, it's important, but now let's get back to the politics, the partisan politics and the parties' positions on particular issues, guns, mental health funding. What's it going to take to make America great again? It's not going to be politics alone. We have forgotten, writes Dreher, what it takes to maintain a resilient civilization. He cites a number of social scientists who've made this claim and actually have some pretty compelling data to back it up. But here's the deal. Societies that have a large number of young men without mating prospects is a society given over to violent crime and social instability. Nations that have had to deal with this problem in the past have occupied these men with war and colonialism to channel that energy externally. The social scientist he cites points to the sexual revolution, the impact it's having and will continue to have, the massive downstream effects. Nobody wants to hear that because it goes against the narrative, but it happens to be demonstrable from the data. By the way, this is not exactly new. Get to former Harvard sociologist writing about the same topic in a second, but to his point about young men and to the point that we're wont to make routinely on this show, that women are a civilizing influence on men. New York Magazine piece, which included data gleaned from David Shore, Democrat data scientist. In 2009, for the first time in history, there were more unmarried women in the United States than married women. Today, young women in the U.S. aren't just unprecedentedly single. They also appear to be unprecedentedly uninterested in heterosexuality. According to David Shore, listen to this, roughly 30% of American women under 25 identify as LGBT. By comparison, for women over 60, that figure is less than 5%. 6X. Under 25 to over 60. Think that's cultural? 3 out of 10 women under the age of 25 consider themselves to be gay, bisexual, or transgender. Yeah. The U.S. fertility rate is a 35-year low, and there's no reason to think it will rise, writes Dreher. What's behind this is primarily cultural. We have become an antinatalist society. And further, we become a society that no longer values the natural family. We see everywhere disintegration. And now we have 30% of Gen Z women claiming to be sexually uninterested in men. There's nothing remotely normal about that number. It's a sign of a deeply decadent culture that is a culture that lacks the wherewithal to survive. The most important thing that a generation can do is produce the next generation. No families, no children, no future. And by the way, you say, well, they're under 25. It's a cultural phenomenon. They went to one of the Seven Sisters colleges. They'll grow out of it. Well, by the time they grow out of it, they're going to be past, you know, prime childbearing age. So we talk about the family disintegration, the responsibility of mom and dad in the context of all these societal ills that we have unleashed on ourselves. But we don't really want to talk about it. We don't really want to focus on it, hold people to account. We don't really want to put people's attention here. We want to pass a law. If we just increase the age to purchase a sport rifle from 18 to 21, then we won't have any of these problems with our young, unattached men. Yeah, that's not what history tells us. Sorry. Ken in Evanston, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, Dan. I just have one simple thing to say. The streets are flooded with criminals that belong in prison. That's why we built them. We got the wrong people in prison.
We got the wrong people in prison?
Yeah, we got pot smokers in prison instead of violent criminals.
Thanks for the call, Ken.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. America First with Sebastian Gorka, today at 3, right before Sean Thompson at 4 on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Dan, because Amy's off today. She'll be back tomorrow. Michael Schellenberger, still an environmentalist, but now one that no longer serves as a chief propagandist for the Marxists behind the elimination of fossil fuels jihad. Michael Schellenberger, also a candidate for governor in California, writing in the New York Post, yes, you can blame Biden for crazy gas prices. U.S. refineries need to refine more, one of the things that Biden says. Pick it up. But as Schellenberger reports, U.S. refineries are already operating at 94% of their capacity, with U.S. refineries in the Gulf of Mexico running at 98%, which is the highest rate in 30 years. Running refineries at higher capacity than that risks damaging the equipment. So Biden's not just wrong. He insulted some of the hardest working people operating in one of the most dangerous industries in America. Well, but I mean, if you score political points with your base, that's the most important thing. Schellenberger said if Biden wants more American fuel, he should allow the building of new refineries, right? Well, that's not going to happen. And in point of fact, as Schellenberger observes, on May 12th, Biden's Interior Department blocked a proposal to open up more than 1 million acres of land in Alaska for oil and gas drilling. 2 days later, Biden's EPA blocked plans to expand an oil refinery in the U.S. Virgin Islands. But as Schellenberger notes, anybody who cares about air pollution and climate change should want more oil and gas drilling, not less, because U.S. emissions declined 22% between 2005 and 2020, in the last 15 years, mostly because cheap natural gas has replaced coal. It's not economically viable or environmentally friendly. The Biden policies, ironically, isn't it? And Biden's not going to do it, as we know, because he declared war on fossil fuels. We're going to end fossil fuels. That's what he said as a candidate. And that's what he's attempted to do. Schellenberger notes the ideological component of this, which is everything. The problem is that Biden is in the grip of a pro-scarcity ideology that demands humankind return to relying 100% on renewables like we did before the Industrial Revolution. But that's a delusion. Solar panels and electric cars, which rely on lithium battery power, have indeed become cheaper in recent years, mostly because the Chinese use slave labor. If these technologies were made in the U.S. by workers paid a living wage, they would never be affordable. On energy, as with so many other issues in recent years, you cannot believe the experts. They are too motivated by the pro-scarcity romantic delusions that animate Biden's energy agenda. And so when you fill up your car or truck and you feel tempted to blame President Biden for high gasoline prices, go right ahead, because it's really his fault. Put a sticker on the pump if not one's not already there. I did that. For more on this, pleased to be joined by our friend Jim Urio, analyst for Fox Business and proprietor of Brandt's Restaurant in Palatine. Jim, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
Biden did that, says Michael Schellenberger, and he explains why. Seems that's a fairly good summary of the antagonistic attitude toward from the administration towards the energy sector, and the results naturally follow.
The only thing I would challenge on him is he throws around words like blame and fault when realistically this is just the fulfillment of a campaign promise. He talked about it before. He
right.
was extremely clear of what he was going to do to fossil fuels. And there's even some talk of driving the prices up on purpose to hasten the transition to green energy, which we have nowhere near the infrastructure for. So the reality of it is this. I don't know if they really think they're doing good or they think they're doing damage, but in the end, it will certainly be doing damage by trying to move us to something that we're not even close to being prepared for. He talked about refineries a second ago. Just several weeks ago, Mike Wirth, the CEO of Chevron, gave a speech where he said there will never, certainly never, be another refinery built in this country due to regulation, because you need a 10-year time horizon for it to become a profitable investment. And trying to predict the energy policy of this country over the next 10 years is absolutely impossible. So even if they pivoted now, it would take such a long time to instill that sort of confidence in the oil companies and fossil fuel companies to think that things can't just turn on them and all of a sudden they'll be in the crosshairs again. So we're in a bad way with energy policy, and I don't see it getting better. I do see, I believe we're in a recession right now. The Atlanta Fed GDP now says there were negative 2.1% growth, which it's not the most accurate reading in the world, but it's pretty close. If recession happens now, if it's anything worse than a slightly mild recession, oil prices will come lower just based on demand destruction, but that's the wrong way to push them down, in my opinion.
Schellenberger suggests there's things that he could do. He could invoke the National Defense Act to accelerate the rate of oil and gas permits. He could set a floor at $80 a barrel for refilling the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. He could announce trade agreements with American allies to supply them with liquefied natural gas. I mean, there are things that are available for him to do. He's just ideologically unwilling to do them.
So right, and so politically, I think they fully believe that if they do any of those things, then the clips will go against them with the environmental crowd come the next election. And they're probably right. So I don't believe they'll do those things. I certainly wish they would. And any little bit helps. If you can just move things in the right direction, that provides a lot of relief. But I don't think that's in their interest to do it right now.
So where is this going, do you think? I mean, there's some pretty wild predictions out there, like $300 a barrel oil. Where do you think?
I don't see that. I think that it gets to a point where, if wages can't follow, if it's not a whole price wage spiral, then there's a certain level where people will just make other plans and demand will absolutely be destroyed.
Right.
So I don't believe that. What I think now is I think there's going to be a pullback in crude over the next quarter just because that the recession is here. And then I think it could go higher again just based on bad energy policy, and could push it up into the 150s. Those calls for $300 oil, when an analyst makes that call, it always seems like to me they're attention seeking, because to me that seems a little bit ridiculous.
Yes.
And if you're wrong, nobody really brings it back up again because everyone's relieved that you're wrong. So I don't know. That to me is. I had some words that I don't think I could say on live radio, but I don't like that analysis very much.
No, I know that's fodder for one of those Investotainment newsletters to get you to sign up. I get that, but sort of the point it was not the necessarily the $300 prediction, but that we're going to be at $110, $150, $120 barrel, that we're going to have $6, $7, and $8 tanks of gas for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, but I don't So historically, it was believed that $4, I'm talking about the last 30 years, believed that $4 a gallon is where demand was destroyed. I argued 6 months ago that that ceiling was gone just because everything has gone up so much and they've added 40% to the money supply since then. So there's a lot of different factors in this. One of them is that when you add 40% to the M2 money supply, the dollars that you hold are just worth less money. So everything that you are going to buy is going to be more expensive. The normal, the right price of it becomes higher. Brian Westbury, just I had him on my podcast. He was talking about how just boil it down. If you had $10 and 10 apples, and that was it. Each apple was worth a dollar. Now all of a sudden you have $14, and those apples are factually more valuable just based on the fact that you've added to the money supply. I know it's a pretty rudimentary example of it, but that's what's happened too. So houses being more expensive, crude being more expensive is a function of many things, but not the least of which is the dollar. So I don't think it's going down, but I think that the right price, the price that won't do damage to the economy, is probably about $4 a gallon.
Mm-hmm. But and is there any way to measure elasticity of demand for gas such that, you know, you, as you say, you cap out at a certain point and people find substitutes?
Yes. Well, the stuff that comes out of the EIA is invaluable. In fact, is predicting like people's what they'll do during the driving seasons in the summer. But so everyone who doesn't trade it thinks in terms of demand and supply. You also have to add in market position. There's tons of speculators around the world who buy oil futures, who buy gas futures, think it's going to go higher and higher and higher. So if that market turns around, because it's gone too far on the upside based on those speculators, but the opposite can happen too. If you turn it around and the narrative changes and gas and oil start to go lower, then all of a sudden you start to knock out all those long speculators and it pushes even lower still. And that's what we kind of want to happen, to trim the hedges in that market. Does that make sense, by the way?
Yeah, it does.
Okay, good.
Here locally, I wanted to get your take on this. We haven't talked to you since Ken Griffin announced that he was moving Citadel effectively to Miami. I mean, he'll have a footprint here, but it won't be the same. And one of the reasons he cited, of course, was it's unsafe for his employees here. This past weekend with 55 shot and 7 dead doesn't help that at all. The impact, your sense of the impact of Citadel leaving on the heels of Boeing and Cat from Chicagoland at Caterpillar and Deerfield.
I think it's a big deal. I think it's a much bigger deal than people think. And I know.
Do you think it's another piece of a daisy chain? In other words, does CME Group go right behind him?
Well, I obviously can't and won't comment on the CME Group being a member myself.
Okay.
I don't want to get in any sort of big trouble.
All right.
But as far as the economic landscape in Chicago, it's definitely changed, and the reputation of Chicago has taken just enormous hits from safety issue too. You know, when you talk about Ken Griffin, I think we have to talk about the fact that there might be some, and not petulance is the wrong word, but he wanted to push his agenda. And I'm not making any emotional comment on this at all. He didn't get his way, and part of the reason probably that he's moving. I think you would agree with that, wouldn't you?
Yeah. I mean, he's obviously a huge philanthropist, and that's great. And he wanted to get involved in politics, and he wanted to move the state to a more sensible place, and that's laudable too. It's just he made some terrible political judgments, and I'm not just talking about this recent gubernatorial primary. He's made some bad ones previous to this as well over the last couple of cycles, including at the mayoral level. And so I understand why he's frustrated, but, regardless of his motives or the combination of them to move, the impact we're trying to assess, because, of course, you have from the political ruling class, companies come and go. That's their attitude.
Yeah, and that's companies like Citadel don't come and go. Obviously,
yeah,
we both
right.
know that. Yeah. Right. And them going is an enormous deal. But I think you're kidding yourself if you don't think from a macroeconomic standpoint we are witnessing the descent of a great city. Now, people are probably going to exaggerate at the rapidity of it, but there's no question that the momentum and the direction is totally in the wrong way. Could that end up like we're Detroit? Well, Detroit was a different thing considering they, and I'm talking about Detroit back in the 80s or whenever, and they relied so much on one industry more than we ever had here. And when that industry turned, it destroyed them. So our descent is going to be much, much, much drawn out unless we change policies and then are willing to deal with some of the negative ramifications of changing policy when you right off the bat. But yeah, people won't come to a city where they don't feel safe. And I get that, you know, on Twitter, where I talk to people all over the world, and their first thought of Chicago now is dodging bullets. So, you know, it went from Al Capone when I was a kid, to, when you think of Chicago, to thinking of Michael Jordan for so many years, and now we're back to thinking of dodging bullets in Chicago, and that's a horrible thing. You know, why would you build your company there?
Well, right, but you know, trying to gauge this, you know, the big condo buildings still going up, not that they're being filled up, but they're going up. But I mean, when you have the financial titans leave, a lot usually follows. I mean, look at what's happening with banking, the move from the Eastern Seaboard from the Northeast in New York to Charlotte, and tech from California to Austin. Why can't banking and insurance associated with the exchanges and big trading outfits like Citadel move right along with them? And then, yeah, we got Google in the West Loop and so on and so forth. But a couple big players and a lot of medium or smaller players is not enough to sustain this place, certainly at the price that we're currently charging to sustain it.
No doubt. And you remember, for 50 years, the migration from north to south, from cold to warm, has been going on. So we're already fighting a battle that's going against us. But again, I don't want to over exaggerate it too, because it's not easy for people to just pick up and leave and move their companies.
Right.
Plus, we have, you know, so look at the schools, the university. I would argue that there's probably more engineering degrees from top 10 universities that are awarded in a 4-hour drive from Chicago than any other city in the country, just because we have the likes of, you know, Michigan, Purdue, Illinois, Wisconsin. I mean, we have great schools. That's not going away. So there are forces that are propping up Chicago at the same time things are hammering it, like the safety issue. The safety issue's got to be solved right away. And I mean, I don't even think it's that difficult a thing to solve. Guess what happened when they abandoned broken windows policing and abandoned, yeah, you know, pursuing. I mean, again, I'm a little bit out of my lane, but it's all kind of macroeconomic when you think about it. So it deserves the research of any macroeconomic analyst to figure out why Chicago is descending.
Absolutely. I mean, this is Gary Becker territory. Maybe you'll be in line for Nobel Prize if you do some more scholarship on the topic.
I don't think so. I think you've got to be a different side of the aisle to win a Nobel Prize.
Yeah, well, these days.
When an economist wins a Nobel Prize, in my opinion, the first thing I always look for is, what other policy do they espouse that supports the left agenda that eventually they're going to come back and say, well, Nobel Prize winning economist Dan Prof also believes in a cashless society.
Right. Since you mentioned our semi-good universities in the region, this interesting piece from CEO of a healthcare services company in the Journal over the weekend: a rude awakening is ahead for young employees as we go into recession, as you were just describing at the outset of our conversation. This idea that prospective employees are going to dictate the terms of their employment to employers, like whether or not they're going to show up to the office or not, those may be coming to an end. And I wonder what's your assessment of when the lagging indicator unemployment starts to tick up and the landscape changes back to maybe something more like it was pre-pandemic.
No, and I think it's already happened. I think we're going to start to see statistics on that within the next month or so. We're hearing, particularly in the tech industry, they kicked it off saying hiring freezes. They're going to try to pare down employment. So I think that's happening too. I think it's been amazing, particularly in the age group of, you know, just graduating high school to 30 years old. And again, I have two daughters in that age group too. They were absolutely dictating terms to employers, and they still are right now. And that's a tough habit to break. There are certain things, like in the stock market, when changes happen, they happen pretty quickly and you can see it. But when changes happen in real estate, when changes happen in the labor market, it goes a long time, because everyone's got to be convinced of the new world before employers start to be emboldened and not offer things. So I think it's starting to flounder a little bit here, and I think it's going to be in a month we're going to see the absolute statistics that employment is changing.
He is Jim Urio. He's an analyst for Fox Business, also the owner of the wonderful restaurant Brandt's in Palatine. Jim, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Dan. Have a good day.
You too. And he joined us on the Turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy this morning is me, because it's just me. She's back tomorrow. I want to talk about the police-involved shooting in Akron, because this happened early last week, and they released body cam videos over the weekend, had a press conference. We're talking about cops being shot in places like Chicago, Philadelphia, the great work that police, including state police, did up in Highland Park to capture the suspect believed to be the Highland Park 4th of July parade shooter. Well, in Akron, they've got a curfew they've imposed because there is this racial component to the police-involved shooting. Otherwise, nobody would be talking about it. A 25-year-old black man named Jalen Walker was shot and killed by police after fleeing when one officer attempted to pull him over for a traffic violation. We'll get to the details in a second, but the headlines are: unarmed Jalen Walker shot and killed by police. Eight officers opened fire on Jalen Walker. Shot 60 times. But then you hear from Jalen Walker's attorney, who saw, I guess, the same videos. I don't know, maybe he's seen more than has been released to the public, because his description of what he saw and what I saw watching the videos and the press conference over the weekend, not the same. Of course, he's representing Jalen Walker's family. But there's and so the detail that's required. But I got to say, first and foremost, the curfews and the calls for peace. Shouldn't we be a little bit more demanding and a little bit less patronizing? Of violence in response to something you think was potentially unjust, that's not acceptable. If you don't know it, you should. And we're not asking, if you can't express yourself without being violent, then we're going to take you into custody. Simple. No pleases and thank yous. These are the expectations we should have for people who want to live in a civilized, free society. You get to run around and burn things down or start fights or worse because you're upset about something. And I got to say, the Akron officials, including the police chief did a bit of a heckle and Jekyll and Hyde routine at the podium over the weekend. Listen to how he starts, and then wait till you hear what he says after they've played the videos for the Associated Press. Here's a police chief, Stephen Milet, talking to the family of the deceased Jalen Walker. Talking to them, but publicly.
Again, Mrs. Walker, Jada, I'm very sorry for your loss, but I want to personally thank you. I want to personally thank you for the way in which you have been dealing with this situation. You have asked for peace in an environment that is ripe for aggression and violence. You have asked for trust and let this process move forward. If Jalen reflects the character of this family, which I continually heard that he did, you raised a good son. And again, my deepest condolences and sympathies. On Monday morning, officers of the Akron Police Department.
Yeah, you raised a good son. I'm not here to pass judgment on Jalen Walker. But Jalen Walker, as you'll hear, fled police. He fired a gun out of his car. He ran stop signs, he ran red lights, and then he stopped and fled police on foot, despite being told to stop. Then he turned toward police, and then he was shot. It's more complicated than that, and the video is hard to make out in certain portions. But that's the summary of what I saw. So I don't understand this, as I said, this patronizing, this bootlicking. We have standards, and everybody has to abide these standards. That's what they should be talking about. Stop being a politician. And a hack one at that. First video, body cam of the officer responding, the first officer responding. Well, first, let's give you the police summary, which is not too dissimilar from mine, but this is the police summary that prefaces the first body cam video that was made public.
On Monday, June 27th, 2022, at 12:30 in the morning, Akron police officers attempted to stop a silver Buick on East Talmadge Avenue near Thayer Street. Officers informed dispatch that the reason for the stop was for a traffic violation as well as an equipment violation. The driver of the vehicle refused to stop, and officers initiated a vehicle pursuit as the vehicle was nearing the East Talmadge Avenue entrance ramp to Route 8 southbound. Approximately 40 seconds after the driver of the vehicle fled from the attempted stop, a sound consistent with a gunshot can be heard on the body-worn cameras of the officers. Officers notified dispatch that a shot came out of the suspect's car door.
And here's that notification.
21 shots fired. That vehicle just had a shot come out of its door.
So 40 seconds into pursuing somebody who wasn't stopping, that's pretty quick, the shot is fired. And as you'll hear from the police chief later, and as you would know just using common sense, once a shot is fired, it's no longer, oh, it was just a traffic stop, you shouldn't have given chase, which is some of what you're hearing out there. Shouldn't have given chase. Well, now you put the police officer in a position where that is no longer optional because you're shooting a gun out of your car window. Important. And by the way, you can see the flash of light. That's, they still frame it. You can see the flash of light providing evidence that the shot was fired in addition to the real-time report from that officer. The police narrator for this first video then describes the rest of the pursuit.
The vehicle pursuit continued on the expressway for several minutes, and the suspect vehicle exited onto the Archwood Avenue ramp. The pursuit proceeded through several city streets until he neared the intersection of East Wilbeth Road and Claremont Street. At that point, the driver slowed down and exited through the passenger side door of the moving vehicle wearing a ski mask. The suspect fled from the vehicle on foot, turning and facing officers momentarily. He continued to run, evading arrest. Officers attempted to safely take the suspect into custody by deploying their tasers. The deployment of tasers was unsuccessful, and the suspect continued to flee on foot. As the foot chase reached the nearby parking lot, the suspect stopped and quickly turned towards the pursuing officers. Officers reacted by discharging their firearms, striking the suspect. Under visual inspection of the suspect's vehicle, a handgun, a loaded magazine for a handgun, and what appears to be a gold wedding ring were observed in plain view on the driver's seat.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Now, it's difficult to make out because it's dark and because, you know, the body cam video is moving because it's attached to a human being who's chasing. Like the tasers being deployed, difficult to see that. But this is being used by the family's attorney and by those who I think are generally antagonistic towards police, is to indicate, well, they didn't feel that they were under a threat of serious bodily harm or death, and this is why they deployed the tasers rather than fire initially. And that means that they knew that he was unarmed. No, I don't think so. And I don't think you can divine that from the video. What I think you see is he's running away and he has his back to them. And if the taser were deployed anywhere, it was then. Because once he turns and seems to reach for his waist, that's when police open fire. And so it was, you know, non-lethal force initially, and then lethal force, because again, the you had the report of the shot fired from the car window. You have a police giving chase, and there's no time to do an examination of the car in which he fled because they're trying to apprehend the suspect. So they have to assume that he's armed. And then he turns toward them in a menacing fashion. At least it would be understandable to perceive that as a menacing fashion. Doesn't stop, doesn't drop, turns toward them. And so they open fire. So that's the narrator's version. And you can see one version of there's a lot of stills in the sort of packaged video that the police presented. And then there's the actual, the second video they show, which has the first officer responding in pursuit and gives you sort of real-time commentary from the police officer.
Speeds are 70. Now it's in the right lane. Speeds are 70. Light traffic. Vehicles are getting over. Continuing 8 south. Speeds are 78. Light traffic. About 100 yards in front of us, continuing 77 south, just passing.
So speeds of 65 to 80 miles an hour, running red lights, running stop signs. The matter of fact, the officers, in pursuit, it's all matter of fact. There's no hysterics or anything of the sort. He warns other police that are responding as he's giving chase about the shot being fired. Oh, that was her. Here's the warning. That was the pursuit. Hold on a second. Here's the warning to other police officers over the radio.
Yeah, units up there that are coming up on Lover's Lane. He's coming up on your left side just now. Take caution. He was grabbing for a gun. He did fire a shot out of the side of the door.
And that's important because he, not just reporting to dispatch, but now the officer in pursuit telling other officers responding, to take care because a shot was fired. And so, again, it's important because you have to put yourself in the mind of the police officers responding. You have to believe he's armed because you saw him fire a shot. And then when he stops and the foot chase ensues, you have to believe, start from the premise that he's still armed and dangerous. So it's a lot of shots fired. You had 8 officers responding and they turn. And interestingly, unlike, say, in the Laquan McDonald case, all the officers responding, I believe, discharged their weapons. So they saw the same thing independently. That's another thing to note that I haven't seen considered or reported anywhere in this case. Going back now to the police chief in Akron, Stephen Milette, describing the shooting itself.
As you could see in the video, there was a gun recovered from Mr. Walker's vehicle. At the time of the shooting, he was unarmed. Lastly, after the shooting ends, Akron police officers went to Mr. Walker and diligently provided first aid to save his life. One officer on a body cam footage can be heard saying he still has a pulse. As the officers were getting ready to put him into a police car to get him as quickly as possible to the hospital, Akron fire medics arrived on scene. They took over aid. And unfortunately, Mr. Walker tragically passed at the scene.
Going back to the apparent shot that was fired by Walker from his car when police were first giving pursuit, this is another important point.
The shooting occurred. We went back to the scene where we believe the shot was fired. A casing was discovered at that location. consistent with the firearm that Mr. Walker had in his vehicle.
So they found a casing consistent with the weapon, the ammo and the weapon that was found in the driver's seat of his car after he fled his car, and of course they shot and killed him. But so if anybody's going to do that, they threw a weapon down, kind of, you know, the drop gun sort of conspiracy theory. They have now, it sounds like, evidentiary confirmation that he, that the police were right, that the flash indicated from the video confirmed that he did fire a shot. And once he fired a shot, as Chief Milet said,
of the contact, 40 seconds after the initiation of the traffic stop, a half a mile from the location of the traffic stop, you hear the gunshot and then everything else that I've just discovered. And again, that changes the whole nature of the traffic stop. It went from being a routine traffic stop to now a public safety issue.
And here again, you know, it's like talking about these mass shootings. How many times do we have to raise the same issues? These are eminently more preventable than the mass shootings are, aren't they? Don't run. That's the talk you should have. Don't run. Comply with the officer. If you were treated unfairly, that's why we have courts of law. Do not run. You think any of those officers were looking to kill Jaylen Walker that night? No. He put himself and them in an impossible situation as soon as he fired that gun. He put himself in an impossible situation, too. How is that going to end for Jaylen Walker? How is that going to end? Rather than stopping because he was being pulled over by police, even if it was, and I don't know this, maybe a permit, I don't know. Even if he was going to be charged with a moving violation and with unlawful possession of a weapon or something. Is that better than how it went down? What do you think you're going to do when you run? Why isn't this part of a conversation in the community? How do you think it ends? It ends with you being hurt or killed, or you hurting and killing someone else. That's an impossible situation for all parties involved. The coverage of this, as per usual, has been disappointing, to be generous. And curfews and patronizing. How about real talk? There's no reason that young man had died that night. But I'm sorry to say, real talk, he brought it on himself. How many bad decisions did he make that night? Wasn't one, wasn't two, wasn't three, wasn't an accident. Mike and Beverly, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, Dan. You brought it up, you know, when they were bashing Van Dyke, they were saying, you know, no other officers fired almost every single one on this, I believe. So then what a reasonable officer did. Almost every officer did it in this case. So
yeah,
they're all seeing the same thing.
Yeah, thanks for the call. And again, I mean, you go watch the videos online yourself, make your own judgment on it. And some of it's, as I said, difficult to make out. And the one they've got still, so that helps a little bit. But I get that this could be open to interpretation. You want to raise questions about her or his family's attorney, well, fine. But, I mean, you just follow the logical thread here and where the evidence leads. I don't think this is a close call. I don't think this is a close call at all. Michael on the South Side.
Good morning, Dan. Thank you for taking my call. Unfortunately, to the activist crowd, and to the American left, facts don't matter. What we're seeing here is a replay of the usual playbook. Keep the racial pot stirred up. And conveniently, this shooting happened, you know, 4 months before the midterms. What better way to keep the racial pot stirred up and motivate voters than by showing, by providing distorted coverage of a really tragic situation.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Mike. Well, I mean, if that's the way the left wants to play it, then good luck, because with what's happening in major cities around the country right now, starting here in Chicago, you know, you want to resurrect the defund the police movement? Good luck to you, politically at least.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
Insert Democrat Socialist here.
Runs the Democratic House for 30 plus years running. He's promising this and he's stealing that. Where can you get that kind of money? He's using your house like his own piggy bank. Gang. You ought to know by now. You can pay off your house here in Illinois, but you can never keep up with the taxes. Oh, how it's always been the plan to have a taxpayer pay no doubt. Not a matter of if anymore, but when you're moving out. I said, when you're moving out.
Top of the morning. That theme music means it's time for us to be joined by Ted Dabrowski, president of WirePoints.com, all things Illinois policy related. And, of course, the big story coming out of the 4th of July weekend is the carnage in Chicagoland, unfortunately. Six dead, 31 injured in Highland Park at the 4th of July parade. As everyone knows by this time, I think the updated numbers I heard on Mike Scott's newscast, 11 dead, 62 shot in Chicago over the weekend. And the first duty of government at every level, as everyone seems to understand, is to provide for the safety of its constituents. We're not doing a great job in Chicagoland. Ted Dabrowski, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning, Dan. Yeah, another sad day yesterday, and of course, a same old sad weekend in Chicago.
So, I mean, you're a North Shore denizen. I mean, I know that this will probably resonate in among North Shore residents, reverberate through the North Shore like something that hasn't occurred since Lori Dan, 35 years ago. Who murdered that 8-year-old boy, Nick Corwin, if you remember, and everybody on the North Shore does, everybody in the region does. It shatters this idea that if you live in a wealthy area, that you're insulated from violence, that you're insulated from these societal ills that we have seen and play out in other communities, from the school shootings to the Waukesha Christmas parade to now the 4th of July parade in Highland Park.
Yeah, you know, this one gets closer to home for a lot of people around here in the North Shore area. You talk to a lot of people here and people are already scared of the downtown, Chicago downtown crime. Lots of people are limiting how much time they spend down there, but then this happens and it's right here at home. And so, noticeably, everybody's a little bit confused, scared, trying to figure it out. Okay, it's a one-off in the sense that these don't happen every day in the same area, but yet, wow, it just happened on Independence Day, where our children are celebrating. It's a really sad moment for lots of people, of course, or for everybody, and of course, it triggers all the thoughts about the stuff you've been talking about all morning: guns and security, and our leadership and what's wrong. And it's a lot of mixed emotions for people, and it's going to take some time to kind of work through them.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many aspects to this, and all of them leave you wanting because you just can't seem to get your arms around why someone would do something like this. What do we know about the alleged shooter? Basically, some of these individuals who've taken to social media who allege that they made music with him because he was sort of some amateur rapper say that he wasn't political. It's not a political statement. There's no evidence he was a gun nut. There's no evidence that he was anti-Semitic. This is what they're saying, and this is unverified, but it sounds like plausible. And there's sort of a community of people on social media talking about the same things, and they sound credible as sort of they were part of the same group as him, or at least for some period of time. And what you take away from the chatter online is that he was some stoned out, isolated young man who fell prey to his own delusion. Some of the videos that are his videos that were posted before, I think some of them have been scrubbed, are you know, bizarre, disturbing, but you can't quite get your head around, at least I couldn't, like, why you're disturbed. It's like a disturbing to a particular point. I don't know. And this is what leaves these discussions, leaves people so unsatisfied with these discussions, because you just can't seem to zero in on something where you say, if this would have happened, then that wouldn't have happened.
Yeah, this is I ran into a parent who used to live, who grew up or maybe lived in Highland Park, you know, used to take their kids to that same parade, who knows the family of the accused. And mentioned that, you know, he's known to be ill in some way, mentally ill. I don't know if, you know, again, legally or not, but there seemed to be good knowledge of that. And yet, right, what could we have done? Should we have done? These are very hard things to figure out. And as you say, there's so many influences coming in here, and it's really hard to second guess what could have been done. But certainly, what keeps coming up with you know, young people like this is they've got, you know, some serious issues, many of which are public, but, you know, it's kind of hard to know what to do with that, because there's probably lots of people like that with issues who don't become, you know, shooters. And so it's a really difficult issue.
Well, and here you have, I mean, the reporting on this is that his father has a business in town, and that he ran for mayor just a couple of years ago. So it's somewhat of a public figure or known figure, if that reporting is accurate. And this was Fox News reporting it. And right. I mean, so this is not, you know, he obviously was not successful in his campaign for mayor, but it doesn't sound like it's not an outsider. It's not, you know, somebody some strolling through town. It's not somebody without some public profile and then ostensibly relationships in the community. And so, you know, these are one of the things where it's like you can't wrap your head around it. Well, I want to get to something else too, sort of fold in on the law enforcement side, because this report that Matt Rosenberg did that was posted at Wire Points last week was just staggering, particularly in light of the other headline about violence in Chicago. As I said, 11 dead and 62 shot over the weekend, and you saw, many of people saw these videos of how police were being treated by all these honor students that were reenacting Rebel Without a Cause and throwing fireworks in cop cars and injuring cops, and one cop getting ambushed at a response to a domestic in Little Italy, and so on and so forth. The Matt Rosenberg report on the number of 911 calls for which the response was no police available, and these were priority one and priority two calls. So priority one, you know, serious bodily injury is involved or could be. And priority two is police officer could make the difference in keeping the peace. So these are serious calls.
Yeah, it was fascinating. You know, we are working on that. We were hearing about what are called radio assignments pending. These are periods in which, you know, long periods in which there is no police to respond to a 911 dispatch for something serious. And, you know, in 2001, they were more than twice the number that were in 2019. And so that caught our eye. But more important was how many calls were not responded to. And it's shocking when we got back to FOIA, because, you know, there's 400,000 non-responses in a whole year to these very serious issues. And let me give you a list of this. It's 15,000 assaults in progress that they could not respond to in a timely manner. Almost 18,000 batteries in progress. There were 16,000 incidents of a person with a gun that were not responded to. I can just keep going on. 13,000 shots fired. 887 persons stabbed. Now, here's the problem, Dan. You know, this is obviously a problem, because you're talking about crimes that police can't show up to in a timely manner. But, you know, this is what happens when you get no support from city leadership, you know, or said differently, you know, anti-support of the police. Then you've got this anti-policing legislation that keeps piling on. You've got this, deprosecution going on. Then you've got the damaging rhetoric of the defund movement. All those things take a toll on how the Chicago police can work and their manpower. And so here we are, 2,000 policemen fewer. It's hard to say how many policemen we actually need. But what I can tell you this is, if you destroy the morale and destroy the policing efforts, and if you destroy their ability to actually police, then this is what you get: 400,000 non-responses. And that's, yeah, you talk about the murders are one thing.
Yeah.
Add 400,000 non-responses, and you got a city that's not livable for lots of people.
Well, and also too, I mean, so you a couple of things there, right? You have criminals who know that they're not going to be prosecuted by Kim Fox. They're going to be turned back out. And that's if they get captured at all. 16,000 incidents with a gun not responded to. You said thousands of stabbings. So now you're just saying that nobody's around to stop you from doing whatever you want to do, taking whatever you want. And we see this happen over and over. And that is one massive problem. And then the other is with police, and even if you had an administration that was interested in staffing the police department, you can't get anybody to go to the academy. And this is even after they lowered the standards in the spring to try and attract more police recruits to the academy. And it's for the same reason.
We're going to have to flip this whole thing upside down, Dan, because it is so far gone. And when you watch those guys opening the car door of a police car and throwing in whatever fireworks, whatever the hell they're throwing in there, when they're that emboldened to do that and knowing that there's little consequence for doing it and that policemen are handcuffed themselves, it is a system that is, you know, it's going to fail. And we're going to have to flip the whole thing, and it's going to take a much different kind of leadership. You know, we should be talking about recalls. We can't continue like this, because it's going to destroy Chicago, and of course it's going to bleed to other places as well.
Ted Dabrowski, president of Wirepoints, wirepoints.com, all things Illinois policy related. Ted, thanks as always.
Thank you, Dan.
And he joined us on the Turnkey.pro answer line.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, because Amy's off today. She'll be back tomorrow. Governor Pritzker went up to Highland Park after the shooting at the 4th of July parade yesterday, before a suspect was in custody, before families had been notified of those who were killed or injured, and used the occasion to talk gun confiscation.
It is devastating that a celebration of America was ripped apart by our uniquely American plague. A day dedicated to freedom has put into stark relief the one freedom we as a nation refuse to uphold, the freedom of our fellow citizens to live without the daily fear of gun violence. If you're angry today, I'm here to tell you, be angry. I'm furious. I'm furious that yet more innocent lives were taken by gun violence. I'm furious that their loved ones are forever broken by what took place today. I'm furious that children and their families have been traumatized. There are going to be people who say that today is not the day, that now is not the time to talk about guns. I'm telling you, there is no better day and no better time than right here and right now. It's the 4th of July, a day for reflection on our freedoms. Our founders carried muskets, not assault weapons. And I don't think a single one of them would have said that you have a constitutional right to an assault weapon with a high-capacity magazine, or that that is more important than the right of the people who attended this parade today to live.
Not much of a constitutional scholar, but it's worse than that. He's really a cynical demagogue. That's what we've come to expect from politicians in Illinois and Chicago. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by John Lott, president of the Crime Prevention Research Center, former senior advisor for research and stats at the Department of Justice's Office of Legal Policy, author of books including Gun Control Myths and More Guns, Less Crime. John, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me on.
So your response to what the governor had to say and the timing on which he said it.
Well, look, I mean, I think everybody wants to do something, and I'm happy to do something. I guess I think what the governor wants to do is largely going to either no effect or counterproductive. Just to start off, he's simply wrong to say that the United States is unique in terms of these mass public shootings. We may cover the United States attacks a lot more in the United States than we covered them in other countries, but you know, if you look at countries in Western Europe, or particularly Eastern Europe, or let alone outside of Europe, you find many countries that have much higher per capita rates of mass public shootings. One thing you have to take into account is we have a country of over 330 million people. Many countries in Europe, which may have 5 million, 8 million people, the largest country in Europe has 80 million people. Germany has had several big school shootings, since 2000. We've had 9 mass public school shootings since 2000. So, you know, you adjust for their population, they actually have a higher rate per capita than we have here in the United States. And there are many countries like Finland, which is a population of 5 million people, which has a much, much higher per capita rate, Russia. We could go on. Just one minor thing. You know, if you compare Western Europe to the United States, let's say over the last 10 years, which countries have had the worst mass public shootings? You have France in 2015, which had 130 people killed at the concert in November that year. You had Norway, which 10 years ago had a mass public shooting in which 67 people were shot to death. The big thing is you look at the vast majority of these mass public shootings, 96% of the mass public shootings occur in the United States occur in places where guns are banned. These killers are not stupid. They want to go and get media attention, and they know that the more people they kill, the more media attention that they're going to be able to get.
I think
I want to do something, but
yeah, I mean, I think part of it is, you know, when there's a clear motivation, you understand it and you feel like you can attack it, Islamist terrorists or something like that. When there doesn't seem to be any discernible motive, and you sort of categorize it as mental illness, but you're not really sure. And could, you know, when you can't get your arms around it, like we can't get our arms around, at least right now, this Highland Park 4th of July parade shooting, it leads people to say, well, if we can't figure out what motivates the instrument, then let's attack the instrumentality. And that's what you had Pritzker doing yesterday, talking about sport rifles.
Look, the van, who knows yet what the guy in Highland Park was, his motivation was. So I assume we'll find out eventually.
Or not.
The vast majority, well, maybe not, but he's alive, so at least makes it more likely.
Yes.
The vast majority of these people, when you read their diaries, when you read their manifestos, are doing this to commit suicide. At some point along the line, people figured out that because people have always wanted to commit suicide, but they figured out that they could commit suicide in a way that would get the media attention, that people would know that they had been here. People who feel guys who feel unappreciated, basically,
right?
You know, who can't get women to go out and dates with them or whatever. And I'm not calling for abolition of the First Amendment so that the media doesn't cover these attacks and get these guys publicity. But if you want to try to take away their motive, you have to take away the publicity they get. And the way to do that is to limit the number of people they can kill on the attacks. And the way you do that is have somebody there
who can quickly respond. And that's the reason why in the vast majority of these attacks, these killers pick targets where they know victims can't defend themselves. So it's the reason why the Tulsa hospital shooting or the school shooting in Texas or the Buffalo shooting, you know, these guys pit gun prisons. You read the manifesto for the Buffalo shooter. He explicitly talks about what type of target he wanted to attack. He wanted to go to a place where he knew his victim there wouldn't have permanent concealed handguns to be able to go and protect them.
Yeah, and in the case of Highland Park, you've got somebody who climbed on top of a building to be in a sniper position to have an open look at people just milling about, right?
Well, I mean, and that's a very difficult one to stop. But
yeah,
look, you know, it's the governor wants to go after so-called assault weapons. You know, maybe he doesn't even know what he's talking about there.
I suspect
he probably does, though. And that is, you know, we're talking about AR-15s or whatever. We're talking about guns that are essentially the exact same as a semi-automatic hunting rifle. They just look different on the outside. The key term is often military style, where the word is style is what's actually the difference there. They fire the same bullets with the same rapidity, doing the same damage as a small caliber semi-automatic hunting rifle. 85% of the handguns in the United States are semi-automatic. A similar percentage of rifles in the United States are semi-automatic. If he wants to ban 85 to 90% of the guns that are sold in the United States, fine, let's talk about that. Just don't go and just use magical terms like assault weapon.
No, he won't abide that. That's what he's going to do. That's what they're going to do, because you know that's what they do, and that's what he did yesterday. And speaking of governors like him, Kathy Hochul signing legislation into law on Friday in the wake of the Supreme Court holding in that New York gun case that now, in order to get a right to carry permit, people will have to turn over a list of their social media accounts over the last 3 years so that officials can verify their character and conduct. They'll need to meet with a licensing officer for an in-person interview in addition to 16 hours of firearm training and agree to store all firearms securely, whatever that means, according to the legislation. How do you react to that response from New York State?
Well, I think it's going to be challenged, and I think it's going to be a few years before the courts completely iron things out. I think it goes against the rules that are there. You know, the governor last week in a press conference was asked why she's going after concealed carry permit holders, given how law-abiding they are. And the governor basically said she didn't need to have any numbers to go and look at how law-abiding permit holders are. The reporter, I was actually stunned, was pressing her on it, because it's not something that you see reporters normally do on the gun control issue against these gun control governors that were there. But, you know, you look at the numbers. And the type of person who goes through the process in Illinois or other states to go and get a concealed carry permit is incredibly law-abiding. They are convicted of firearms-related violations at about 1/12 the rate the police officers are convicted of firearm-related violations. And police are convicted at about 1/20 the rate of the general population.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you're talking about people who are extremely law-abiding. And, you know, the main reasons that permit holders lose their permits for any firearms-related violations are things like forgetting to have their permit with them, you know, when they're out. So, you know, we have 43 right to carry states where you don't have provide a good reason to some public official for why you should be able to go yourself outside the home. We have 18 states that have changed from May issue to right to carry, which is what we're talking about New York having to do. And not one of those states, not one of the 43, not one of the 18 that are there, even had a legislative hearing, let alone a vote on moving back to a May issue type of rule. And you would think that there were problems there. One of these states, some legislator, someplace, would have put forward a bill that there would have been a hearing on if there had been problems. And yet these governors from whether it's Gavin Newsom in California or Huckle or in New York are saying that the world's going to end because they're going to be like the other 43 states that are out there.
I want to but before I let you go, I want to get your reaction to one study that would challenge some of the data research that you've done. This is a working paper that's out from Stanford Law School professor and a Duke University econ professor. This is the summary of their working paper. We analyzed a sample of 47 major U.S. cities to look at the mechanisms that led right-to-carry concealed handgun laws to increase crime. They altered behavior of permit holders, career criminals, the police combined to generate 29 and 32% increases in firearm violent crime and firearm robbery, respectively. The increased firearm violence is facilitated by a 35% increase in gun theft, with further crime stimulus flowing from diminished police effectiveness as reflected in a 13% decline in violent crime clearance rates. The upshot is any crime inhibiting benefits from right to law abiding citizens having the right to carry are eclipsed by the crime stimulating impacts, so they argue in this working paper recently posted.
Right. Look, are there a small minority of academic studies that claim to find a bad effect? Yeah. But, you know, I wish the media was a little bit more skeptical. They seem to cover these working papers that find a bad effect, but they don't cover the three times more frequent papers that you have that find the opposite. And, you know, I guess it just fits their narrative. Look, if you have a paper, is it obvious to pick 47 cities? What 47 cities do you pick in the United States? You know, these guys have put together a number of papers over time. They use a different set of factors that they try to account for other things in each of these different papers that are there. They look at different time periods in each of the different papers. You know, if you throw out a lot of data, you better have a good reason why you're doing that. Okay. When I do my work, I look at all the cities or all the counties or all the states that are available for as many years as the data is available for. I run lots of different specifications with lots of different combinations of control variables to try to, you know, take into account different factors because different people think different things matter. And, you know, If I picked just 47 cities, or some papers have picked, you know, 23 counties or something from the United States, you know, you have like 3,140 counties. How do you pick 23? You know, is there an obvious reason? Yeah. The paper ought to provide a good, solid explanation for why they're throwing out most of the data to pick just a small sample to go and make comparisons with. And unfortunately, this paper doesn't do anything. And again, I kind of wish the media, when they would cover these things, would say, you know, there's 54 papers that have been published in peer-reviewed academic journals. Most of them find reductions in violent crime after these laws go into effect. I mean, there are other issues with this research that's there. One of the things I've tried to point out for over 20 years is that there are huge differences in education. Let's compare Illinois with Indiana. Indiana has about 22% of the adult population with a concealed carry permit. In Illinois, it's 4%. Why the difference? In Indiana, it costs about $12.95 to get a permit for 5 years. In Illinois, if you add up the permit and training costs, you're talking about something over $400. So not only does it mean you get a lot fewer people, it also changes who gets the permit.
Yeah.
In Illinois, it's much more wealthy whites who live in the suburbs. That's fine. I'm glad they're protected, but they're not the ones who are most likely victims of crime. You're seeing a much greater reduction in violence in Indiana than you're going to see in Illinois. Not only because you have a much... I'm sorry.
Yeah, John, we got to leave it there, but I appreciate it. The comparison to Indiana and Illinois, I think our listeners get the point that you're making and where the need for self-protection is greatest in Chicago, of course. John Lott, president of the Crime Prevention Research Center, former senior advisor for research and stats at the Department of Justice's Office of Legal Policy, author of books including Gun Control Myths and More Guns, Less Crime. John, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you for being there.
And he joined us on the turnkey.pro answer line.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's morning answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Ann. Amy's off today. She'll be back tomorrow. Continuing a discussion we've been having all morning about the violence in Chicagoland, and specifically because of the horrific nature of it and the questions surrounding the suspect in custody for murdering six people and injuring another 31 people attending the 4th of July parade in Highland Park. This recent spat of stories about legal marijuana and heavy marijuana usage among young people and the psychosis it can induce in some at a certain level of usage. This was before he sort of became famous for all things COVID related. Former New York Times reporter Alex Berenson wrote a book, Tell Your Children the Truth About Marijuana, Mental Illness, and Violence. And it was in part inspired by his wife's experience as an emergency room physician. And here again, I want to be careful. I'm not suggesting causation because there's not the evidence to support it. But correlation is relevant to the discussion. This is why we have prescriptions, why we're talking about red flag laws when it comes to gun ownership or previous history of mental illness when it comes to gun ownership or previous incidents of criminal behavior when it comes to owning guns. Well, there has been this celebration of the legalization of marijuana, and it's become hip and cool. Well, what are some of the implications? Because we know one of the things from, I mean, I believe we know, if you believe some of the social media chatter online about the suspect in custody in the Highland Park murders, that he was an isolated stoner. Dr. Ronit Lev is an emergency doctor at Scripps Mercy Hospital in San Diego. He says, we've been seeing the problems for a while now. Depressive breakdown, psychosis, suicidal thoughts, all related to cannabis. The patients are regular people, not down and outs. I want people to know the truth about this drug. We've been sold a lie that cannabis use is harmless and even the multitude of health benefits, and even has a multitude of health benefits. It is exactly the same as what happened with tobacco. The industry told the public it was good for their health at first before it was proven to be deadly. Dr. Lev, who's in San Diego at Scripps Mercy, as I mentioned. In California, hospital admissions for cannabis-related complications have shot up from 1,400 in 2005 to 16,000 by 2019. In California, the other 18 states who have legalized marijuana, rates of addiction are nearly 40% higher than states without legal cannabis, according to research by Columbia University. This is not inconsequential, as is the conversation about psychiatric drugs and the correlation with respect to these instances of mass killings, the correlation between being a heavy cannabis user, the correlation between being under the influence of psychiatric drugs. Part of the conversation, not causation, correlation. I understand. I say it all the time. The challenge when you come to causation is you have to explain why that many other people are similarly situated. In fact, one would argue the overwhelming majority similarly situated do not commit acts of violence. But increasing the incidence is a substantive part of the discussion if that's what's happening. A group that was opposed to legalization has been compiling a list of mass killers that it claims, this group, were heavy users of marijuana from a young age, including the Aurora, Colorado movie theater shooter, the Tucson, Arizona shooter that shot Gabby Giffords, the Chattanooga, Tennessee shooter. FBI, this is a Miranda Devine piece, the New York Post. 2018 FBI report that 40% of active shooters in the U.S. between 08 and 2013 had been diagnosed with mental illness before the attack. 70% had mental stressors or mental health concerning behavior. That seems to be the case with the individual who's suspected to be the Highland Park shooter. And so the argument goes, if you're interested in preventing future such massacres, the so-called red flag legislation that Trump and other people are advocating to deny people with mental illness access to firearms, should we not also apply to marijuana use, seeing as there's a lot of evidence that they go hand in hand? We've got a lot of studies on this, and we've known for a while that there is some correlative link between marijuana and psychosis, depression, and schizophrenia. The medical journal The Lancet, 27 study, an increased risk in psychosis of about 40%. A seminal long-term study of 50,000-plus Swedish Army conscripts found that those who had tried marijuana by age 18 had 2.5 times the risk of being diagnosed with schizophrenia in the following 15 years compared to those who hadn't used the drug. Heavy users were more than 6.5 times more likely to be admitted to a hospital for schizophrenia. There's a study in New Zealand that found that those who used cannabis at age 15 to 18 had higher rates of psychotic symptoms at age 26 than non-users. A study in the British Medical Journal of 2000 teenagers found those who smoked marijuana were twice as likely to develop psychosis as those who don't. Another British Medical Journal study estimated 13% of cases of schizophrenia could be averted if all cannabis use was prevented. Again, it's not the whole answer. And it's a subject worthy of discussion, but it's not discussed. The left just goes to guns, and we get into mainly a debate about guns versus mental illness or what to do with the mentally ill as it pertains to guns. And when we talk about throwing some money at mental health funding or some such thing, sometimes you get into, you know, other aspects of what we should do, but it's all related to guns. And there are other factors. I mean, video games is mentioned, pornography is mentioned, incels. There's a lot of angles into this discussion, but this has to be one of them based on the science. This has to be part of the discussion, it seems to me. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. John in Florence, Wisconsin.
You stole all my thunder, well, bunches of it, but good for you, because let's have the discussion. Governor Rotundo brought it out, that on days like this, instead of prayers and everything else, condolences, let's have a discussion. But let's have a discussion about the causes, the mental illness. Let's have a discussion about what the Second Amendment was meant for the well-regulated militia, which back in those days meant when the church bell rang, you grabbed your weapon and you went out the door. Let's talk about not trusting the government. Let's talk about the racism, the endemic racism when we're going to worry about what goes on in Highland Park, but 11 are dead and 70 shot in Chicago, and without knowing the numbers, the majority of those are people of color? Let's have the discussion. Let's talk about first-person shooter video games. Let's talk about mental illness. Let's talk about ages, because the brain isn't developed until people are 24 or 25. Mm. But we're going to go into gender assignment and have those kind of things, and that's not a mental illness, but having a gun is. Let's have all these discussions, especially before the midterm. Let's talk about glorification of Hollywood violence. Let's talk about all the role models on TV. Anybody want to talk about school? And what the public schools has gone through? Any of this? I have to take a drug test, a physical. I have to pass background checks by the United States government to deal with the post office and my company, along with being able to transport what we do for the post office and hazmat and stuff. I'm willing to take a drug test to have a concealed carry or just a gun license, you know, and fill out everything else. I'm up in Wisconsin. I used to be down in Illinois. I used to live in Tinley Park in Oak Forest.
We hear that a lot.
Get over this. Let's have it. Let's just do it. But both sides of the equation, Dan.
Thanks for the call. Thanks for the call, John. Tony, Downers Grove.
Wow. Well, to follow on John, I mean, he stole my thunder, because I worry about the midterms because the issues keep coming up, and so many issues are complex, as you just been pointing out, but they're talked about in a service level manner. You know, you look at gay marriage. You know, you always talk about, Dan, how do we get to this point? Well, you get to this point because there's complex issues and they're blanketed by simplistic talk. So going into the midterms, I'm afraid about not taking back Congress or the Senate. Because you have two current issues, well, one with guns keeps on coming up, but then you have Roe v. Wade. And I say, well, let's have the discussion. Let's not say these aren't going to be issues come midterm. We need to make these issues, and we need to talk about these, because they're not isolated to states. They're isolated. They're not isolated at all. This people feel this across the country, but the media is always going to portray it in one way. And I fear that if this goes by the wayside, that you're not going to see any type of a red wave whatsoever.
Hmm. Thanks for the call, Tony. Dave and Carol Scream.
Yeah, I just I thought it was interesting you were talking about the correlation between marijuana and
psychosis,
gun violence.
Well, yeah, psychosis, yeah. Really, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right, and I just thought, you know, it's interesting. I wonder how many of these people are self-medicating because there's already a pre-existing condition there. And so they are seeking help through other things like marijuana and, pornography or other ways to find releases.
Hmm. All right. Thanks for the call, Dave. I mean, look, this from Alyssa Finley writing the Wall Street Journal. A meta-analysis found the risk of perpetuating violence was more than twice as high for young adults who use marijuana as compared to those who don't. It's possible pot can trigger dangerous behaviors in youths who may be predisposed to it for other reasons, such as prenatal exposure to drugs or other reasons, other traumas in childhood and so on and so forth. Again, it's complicated. And for the politicians that say, this is the magic wand and you just have to wave it with me, like Governor Spalding did in Highland Park yesterday, they should be ashamed of themselves, but they have no shame. So they're not going to be, but they're not helping. They're not proposing anything that is sensible, that attempts to deal with all of these variables, that looks at these things as case specific, so that perhaps we can do things that are cultural in nature in addition to legal. You know, change the culture around, for example, celebrating marijuana usage. Does it eliminate everything? Is it the causal link? Nope. Not saying that. But it's a contributing factor, at least in terms of what the science tells us about the incidence of psychosis, and then what the data tells us about the incidence of violence associated with the incidence of psychosis. Something. William in Wilmette.
Hey, how are you, Dan?
Good, thank you.
You know, we live in Wilmette, of course, and what caught us off guard over the weekend was a complete lack of any American flags up in these municipalities. We saw gay pride flags all over, no American flags, and there was almost, you know, there's many houses that were flying American flags, but these cities have decided that it's just not important anymore. It's not part of the regime.
Mm-hmm.
And then last night we came down to the city and in a very popular restaurant at the bar, my wife and I, and a woman starts chatting us up about Highland Park and the disaster that happened. And I brought up the mental illness thing. And she literally created such a scene at the bar and that and called us sick for blaming mental illness. And it wasn't the gun. In her world, it was the guns that caused the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I run into this over and over and over again, that these people, it is, they are completely this mass hypnosis. And I think the governor, he is just trumpeting, and he doesn't care about these people. He only cares about the gun grab.
Yeah.
It was obvious yesterday in his behavior.
Thanks for the call, William. Yeah, well, here again, people then, you say, don't want to talk about mental illness. We have to talk about mental illness. But then they get upset if you're, quote-unquote, stigmatizing the mentally ill. Said the same thing here. It's like there's a lot of people diagnosed schizophrenics, most people, who never commit an act of violence. So it's not, you know, it's not causal. It's incidence, predisposition, likelihood. We're dealing in with gradations here. But that's not what you get from, unfortunately, that woman you run into at the restaurant who's not capable of an adult conversation, as well as, for example, with our governor, who's also not capable of an adult conversation. Kevin, Austin, Texas.
I feel bad for anybody that was in between the microphones and the governor up in Highland Park, because he couldn't get there fast enough in a nice, rich, white neighborhood to get in front and trump in this talking point. Where has he been the last 4 years in Chicago, in the neighborhoods that people are getting killed regularly? He's not there. If I was on the West, if I lived on the West Side or the South Side, where all this is happening, I would be furious. Okay, now he's upset. Why hasn't he been upset before that? And then what he's going to do is for the next 4 years, or I'm sorry, next 4 months, he's going to try to say, oh, I'm doing something. And he'll probably do that now. But it's all disingenuous. Where has he been for the last 4 years? The reason he went out there so quickly, because he can get some media attention, because he's probably running for president. He doesn't care about Illinois.
Thanks for the call, Kevin.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.